What a crazy week of politics. And while the French voters ponder the temptation of the far right, across the channel, they're also campaigning. Only there, it feels like revenge of the moderates. Out with Little Britain Brexiteers, out with Jeremy Corbyn's hard left, in with a more genteel version of the Labour Party. Before 2016, Britain always seemed like that Isle of Temperance, where sure, the tabloid headlines screamed, but that was just a bit of fun to sell newspapers. So what next for Brexit Britain? And the Tories, which have become the party of Rwanda deportation schemes for asylum seekers, does it too swing back to the centre, or does it double down? If he wins by a predicted landslide, Labour leader Keir Starmer will have to will have managed to capture the silent majority that's not radical. But for how long? With a platform that's light on specifics, he knows he can't be all things to all people for very long. If Brexit proved a cautionary tale for the continent, then here's one in the other direction. In France, we had a moderate candidate who promised to take on board the best of the left and the best of the right. His name was Emmanuel Macron. Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at the UK's swing to Labour. And joining us from Hebden Bridge, that's in the north of England, Jamie Furlong, research fellow at the University of Westminster, author of The Changing Electoral Map of England and Wales. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Financial Times columnist Simon Cooper, the author of Good Chaps, How Corrupt Politicians Broke Our Law and Institutions and What We Can Do About It. Good to see you, Simon.
Hi, Francois.
Journalist Julian Nundy is with us as well. And you voted.
I voted. I voted about 2 weeks ago by
and
mail.
This is a novelty for the British abroad.
This is a new law that came in January of this year, which allows all Britons living abroad to vote. And this up until now, it's been as a 15-year rule. You had to have lived in Britain in the past 15 years. And this law was promised by David Cameron in his 2010 election manifesto. And it took only 14 years to get it into action.
Julian Nundy, who famously did not vote in the Brexit referendum. Mm-hmm. Florence Fauché, Director of Research at the Centre for European Studies at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. Thank you for being with us.
Hello.
You're voting on Sunday, I take it.
Yes, indeed.
All right. You can listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and other fine streaming services. Yeah, it could be Britain's biggest swing of the political pendulum since Tony Blair's New Labour swept to power in 1997. Back then, The Sun famously gauged which way the wind was blowing and endorsed Tony Blair. So it's not a great sign for Rishi Sunak when the cover of the tabloid on voting day will read, "Time to change the manager," and in case you don't get it, there's a little bit in parenthesis there at the bottom of the screen. And we don't mean sack Gareth Southgate, the manager of England. But watch out, Starmer. It's not over yet. Boris is back. Former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who led the Conservatives to a landslide win last time round in 2019, making a surprise appearance at a London campaign rally for Rishi Sunak Tuesday night.
Can I first of all say how wonderful it is? Is it not therefore the height of insanity, if these polls are right, that we are about to give Labour a supermajority, which they will use to make us nothing but the punk of Brussels, taking EU law by dictation with no say on how that law is made, paying into Brussels budgets again? You watch, you watch.
Jamie Furlong, what does he mean by a supermajority and all this talk about taking orders from Brussels?
Yeah, I mean, I think the opinion polls at the moment and lots of the statistical models show that Labour are on course to get a huge majority in this election. It could be pretty much the biggest majority since universal suffrage in the UK. So some predictions make it look like Labour maybe win a share of the vote, similar to 1997 when Tony Blair was elected. Others see them gaining this kind of supermajority where the Conservatives, you know, reduced to only around 50, 60, 70 seats in the Parliament. Obviously, it's 326 seats to get a majority, so we're talking about, you know, an enormous Labour majority in the British Parliament.
And Boris Johnson there warning against that. Starmer at a rally in Wales commenting on Rishi Sunak's reinforcements.
I've been arguing that the last 14 years have been about chaos and division. And last night they wheeled out the architect of chaos and division. So I think that just shows the sort of desperate negative place they've got to in their campaign. I'm proud, by contrast, that our campaign from start to finish has been positive, has been confident, and has been about the change that we need in our country.
Simon Cooper, that message has been hammered home now by Starmer for a long time. Is that the secret of his success?
The only word that matters is change. There's enormous discontent with the Conservatives, which isn't so much ideological, it's more just about competence. I mean, this is the party that gave us Liz Truss's budget that sent British assets down, that gave us Boris Johnson's unfit to be a prime minister spectacle of 3 years. And people just, I think, want more sort of trains running on time, basic competence. It's Conservatives are also the party, and this is not discussed, that gave us Brexit. It's not discussed in this election. Neither Labour nor the Tories want to talk about it. But Brexit was another dent in the British economy. The Conservatives' promise until about 2015 is we are the best stewards of the economy. We'll manage it more safely than Labour. That has completely gone. So although Starmer is not promising any particular ideological direction, he's just saying essentially, I'm not the Tories, and I will not do stupid things.
I'm not the Tories, and I will not do stupid things. I mean, he's also been very light on specifics, Julian Nundy, when it comes to things like the National Health Service. He doesn't have a lot of money to promise.
Well, this is going to be the big problem, is where is the money going to come from for the necessary reforms? And probably the first thing it needs doing is a good look at the National Health Service, getting it back on track and reducing the waiting lists, which have now become phenomenal in Britain for routine operations.
François Fauché, what's the view? What do you make of the fact that, as Simon Cooper was saying, no one's talking about Brexit, but of course we watch this election in France, and that's the conclusion we draw, right? That this is the boomerang effect of Brexit.
It is, but it's also that Brexit is toxic, and the Labour Party is being very careful not to bring it up. And it's much more probably effective for them to actually leave that chance to, or the raising the topic to the Lib Dems. For them, it's better not to be seen to reopen the wound of Brexit. And we have to remember how it has hurt many people in the UK. And as we were saying, this is one of the consequences, the impoverishment of many people. And the fact that the promises that were made at the time, in particular by Boris Johnson, of course, have not been kept. So there's a lot of... I don't think it's necessarily anger this time. There was anger previously. But this time it's more kind of resignation and frustration and a desire to move on.
In 2019, Boris Johnson promised to get Brexit done. In doing so, he got a big majority. He smashed the so-called red wall, that is working-class constituencies. You can see them in the north of England that always voted Labour. And according to this map, this is a simulation from the month of May, published by the Daily Telegraph. And it points to a YouGov poll that suggests a return of the red wall. Jamie Furlong, you could see the red wall from your window, right? From where you are in the north of England, in Yorkshire. What's that red wall about? Is that the key to this election?
I think it will be one story from this election. I think, in 2019, the Conservatives did very well in lots of post-industrial towns in northern England. They almost overreached in those places. To win them from Labour. These are places that, you know, have been Labour for generations, often have never been Conservative. Lots of coal mining towns with, you know, lots of kind of cultural ties to the Labour Party. I think at this election, what we're likely to see is the Labour Party are going to definitely regain lots of the seats in the Red Wall, but the majorities are not going to look like the kind of majorities that they had back in 97, potentially, and definitely not going back into the 70s and 80s.
For our viewers here, because in France, the post-industrial towns that used to vote communist have gone for the national rally in places like the north, and they've never returned to the left. Why are you saying they may return to Labour this time? What's the difference?
I mean, I think part of it is something we've touched upon. You know, in 2019, there was a very clear kind of Brexit election. A lot of voters in some of the kind of red wall towns, in towns in particular, rather than the cities like Leeds and Manchester, voted Leave. And, you know, when the election was framed around Brexit and some kind of disillusionment with Jeremy Corbyn as a leader of the Labour Party, I think, you know, that led to a kind of lurch to the right in those areas. I think right now, economically, those places are struggling and, you know, they're looking like a lot of the country for someone to blame. And the party that's been in power for 14 years is, you know, likely to take the flak for, you know, the decline of public services in particular in those areas.
Simon Cooper, in 2019 on election night, Boris Johnson famously told those voters, "I know you're not giving me your vote forever. I'm paraphrasing here. You're lending me your vote. I'm aware of that. Now it could swing back. But is this going to be volatile, where people in those places far from London vote in coming elections? It's the future is unwritten when it comes to where working class voters will go. I ask this because I'm looking at the situation, of course, here in France.
I think the big difference with France is that France is now at the moment UK was in 2016, which is that the offer in 2016 was a nationalist fantasy. Brexit, in the UK's case, we'll go it alone, we'll be a great country like we used to be, we don't need all this immigration, we'll tell foreigners what to do. The UK was leaving the EU, the Rassemblement National is merely promising to tell the EU no, no, no a lot of the time. But so the UK tried this nationalist fantasy. 8 years on, it hasn't worked. Nobody feels better off as a result of Brexit. The economy has taken a dent. Public services are not better. The promise there'd be more money for the National Health Service turned out to be the opposite. There's no money for the National Health Service. So the British are now returning to a much more kind of cautious, low promises, traditional government. France is possibly about to take the dive into a nationalist fantasy and may then, with regret, go back to the status quo. So I think Britain is 8 years ahead of France.
For voters that went for Brexit in 2016, the mood's more bitter than ever. For France 24's Hervé Amouic, he went to Boston in Lincolnshire, the town in England which voted by the biggest margin to leave the European Union in 2016. He filed this report.
The former Conservative mayor of Boston runs this cafe. Born in Morocco, Anton Danny has lived in the UK for 30 years. Like many here, he's concerned about the town's changing face.
Immigration is the main issue. At the moment, we are not having skilled immigration. We have an influx of people coming from Romania and Bulgaria.
Most recently arrived migrants come legally from Eastern Europe to provide much-needed manual labour. But many gather in the town square, and they're not always welcome.
They're affecting schools, GPs, hospitals.
An election debate at a local church. Conservative MP Matt Warman had a comfortable majority for 9 years, but his record is now being challenged.
I just don't feel safe walking out, which I think...
He faces tough questions from a woman who blames immigration for feeling unsafe.
There is no police presence. So why has it not been done yet, and what will be done?
I suppose what I would say is since I was elected, the police numbers in this constituency have gone up.
Appealing to those who fear immigration, Reform UK is the main challenger.
Vote Reform UK.
To boost the chances of the local candidate, Richard Tice, leader Nigel Farage came to town.
The Reform have gone from expecting to win naught seats to 18 seats. We're on our way.
Farage's campaign has been polarising, Reform UK campaigners were recorded by British television making racist and homophobic comments. Raffaella Stefani comes from a family of immigrants, but she supports reform.
We absolutely are against any form of racism, discrimination. Our immigration policies are not about that at all. It's more about, you know, sort of controlling the numbers.
The Labour Party candidate is a former soldier and a teacher who grew up in this deprived area. On her campaign trail, the focus is on healthcare.
I'm speaking to people on the doorstep who cannot get a doctor's appointment. The Labour Party have pledged to start tackling that in week one.
From July the 5th, Labour is likely to be running the country and will be expected to keep their campaign promises.
And that report from Boston and Lincolnshire. Julian Nundy, there you have it. You have the what used to be the UKIP party talking about immigration being this, the root of all evil. You have the Labour Party that instead wants to talk about healthcare. Your thoughts in that, you know, this swing towards moderation, is it brittle?
Well, you know, some people are swinging towards moderation, but obviously not all. Those who are going on and on about immigration and the lack of security on the streets and that sort of thing are not heading towards moderation. They still exist. There's the Reform UK party, Nigel Farage at the head of it now. Yes, the others, the people who were wavering 8 years ago and presumably no longer wavering, and they're going to vote for Labour or other parties, but not for the Conservatives.
France Fauché, again, seeing this through French Eyes' report, what's your reaction?
I think it's important to remember the electoral system, and I think it does a lot, actually, to explain the situation between the two countries. In the UK, the first-past-the-post system means that there is a tendency to vote for the two dominant parties. And actually, since Brexit, we have had the return of the two-party system almost. And here, what we can see is the collapse of the Conservative Party because of the threat of reform. Just as in 2016, Cameron had bet with the Brexit referendum that he would be able to keep UKIP in check in order to consolidate, in a way, the support for the Conservative Party. In France, there's the possibility of voting for all sorts of parties, and we can see how many different parties are actually running in France at the moment and the coalitions that they have to form. It's much simpler in the UK, in a sense.
So hang on, from what you're saying, it's not that Britain is suddenly become this haven of moderation. What you're saying is that the hardline vote is getting split. So is Britain becoming more moderate or not?
I don't think it necessarily is, even though Starmer has campaigned really on trying to not create any wave. As Julian was saying, the Reform Party is carrying on the mantle, if you want, of more polarising policies. And as the report was also showing, the racist discourse remains quite present.
Jamie Furlong, has there been a lot of racist discourse where you are during this campaign?
I mean, not literally where I live, not really. It seems pretty obvious that the Labour Party are going to win lots of support in these parts of Northern England. I actually, to some extent, disagree with this idea that Britain has not become more moderate. I think there's quite a lot of survey research, particularly the British Social Attitude Survey, that shows that over the last decade, and particularly since Brexit, actually on issues such as immigration, the population have become more moderate. And, you know, the issue of immigration until very recently, until particularly the return of reform and Nigel Farage, had sort of declined in salience and become less important as an issue.
Simon Cooper, you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, British attitudes to immigration, I think, are the most positive ever measured. I think they began measuring this about 40 years ago. One thing that the Brexit vote did is it made very clear to people that you need a lot of immigrants to run the NHS, the health service, which is at the core of, I would say, a very large number of British voters' concerns. I mean, the reform voters also understand that voting reform is not to vote a party into power. Farage said in your clip that they would get 18 seats. I mean, they may get zero, they may get five. it's just a protest vote now, partly, as Florence says, because of the first-past-the-post system. Reform is attracting largely people who are disaffected with the Conservatives. Immigration has kind of declined as an issue that British politicians talk about. And I think there's a huge contrast with France, where race and ethnicity are absolutely at the centre of the offering of the largest party, the Rassemblement National, whereas the Conservatives' xenophobia is much more directed against people who don't live in the UK. The kind of small boats arrivals is what they obsess over. The Rassemblement National is targeting people who are French, who are French citizens, who've been born in France, and who, because they are black or Muslim, especially Muslim, are considered suspect by the Rassemblement National. So I think the two elections at the same time highlight better race relations in Britain without obviously saying that Britain is a perfectly non-racist society. Absolutely not.
And the man who took a punt on Brexit was the then Prime Minister, David Cameron. He just won a referendum on Scotland. Critics fumed that in 2016, with Brexit, he posed a question that had not even been demanded by many Eurosceptics. He went away, but then came back last November as a foreign secretary. Simon Cooper, there's been a lot of comparisons between Emmanuel Macron making this, what critics call a shoot from the hip call to dissolve Parliament, and David Cameron's decision to stage this Brexit vote, that they're both punters, taking a bit of a gamble.
I mean, if, like Cameron or Macron, Cameron became party leader, I think, age 39. Macron became president of France, age 39. Everything in your life has gone brilliantly. Every bet you've taken, people said it's much too early, it's not going to work out. Everything worked out brilliantly. You're on top of the world. When Cameron called the Brexit election in 2016, the Brexit referendum, everything he had done in his life had turned to gold. And he expected it would be the same with the referendum. Just like Macron has experienced, I think, the same hubris and thought, well, once I get out there and tell people that the alternative is voting for the far right and that would damage their pensions and tear apart France, etc., they'll listen to me because everything I've done has ever worked until it doesn't. And I think Cameron hit that in 2016, and Macron, unfortunately, is probably going to hit that now.
In France, we've heard a lot this expression in the last weeks, being hors sol, I guess you disconnected is the best way to translate it, Simon. In your book, Chums, you talk about meeting David Cameron years later. You both went to Oxford and sensing that there's this very these little clubs inside of Britain's elite universities. And it could have gone either way, maybe, whether it was the Brexit crowd or not that in the end ruled the country.
Yeah, I mean, in Chums, I describe how both the leading Remainers, like David Cameron and George Osborne, and the leading Leavers, Michael Gove, Boris Johnson and others, had all been at Oxford at the same time, came from a very limited social group, very largely public schoolboys, and sort of knew each other, understood each other to some degree, were fighting out personal rivalries, especially between Cameron and Johnson. All of them were sort of Eurosceptic. Johnson probably not more than Cameron. So to some degree, it was a game played by public schoolboys and unfortunately blew up and damaged the country.
Julie Nundy, was that a change with the past? I mean, there's all countries are ruled by elites. Was there something different with that generation?
I don't think it's a generational thing. I think something different in Britain. I mean, look, they've all been, a lot of the leaders have been to Eton, this very elite school. Now, if they were to be banned from power, who would be running the country? Because when I was a child, the Labour leader, Hugh Gaitskell, even he had been to Eton, and let alone the Tories at the time.
And so this disconnect between...
Well, there's this sense of entitlement that they believe they are there to go into power and to run the country and to run it as they wish. I feel that that's the problem. It's a sort of, they don't set out to deserve their rank.
Jamie Furlong, is the old way of running Britain being called into question after Brexit?
I think to some extent, I think the population definitely desperate for some kind of change. I think right now there's a kind of weariness with politics. There's a kind of weariness with both of the main parties, and we'll see the, you know, the vote shares for Reform and the Liberal Democrats higher, potentially the Green Party higher than they've ever achieved. And I think, you know, some of that is a reflection really of this kind of overwhelming frustration with the way that politics has maybe been conducted in the UK. And a really kind of clear desire for change going forward.
Florence Fauché, again, the comparisons with France, where what we are seeing on the campaign train here is this huge resentment against Paris from the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. And this sense that there are elites that are out of touch. There's too much hubris.
Indeed, and that's certainly a criticism that is directed towards Macron. But at the same time, to just go back to the UK, this desire for change, it's interesting how the Labour Party is bringing change whilst at the same time trying to reassure people that things are going to change, but nothing is going to change. So it's a strange paradox. Whilst in France, indeed, maybe like in 16, as we were discussing, on the contrary, there's a desire for something much more radical and a readiness, therefore, to jump into anything that has not been tried, which is something that we hear a lot and in interviews of people on the street, even though one must start to wonder the extent to which this let's try something that has not been tried before is a kind of phrase that comes from the social networks and all, you know, the kind of discourse that the ambient discourse, in a way.
Is that the difference with the past, the fact that online you can turn this into sort of an all or nothing game?
No, but this idea that the phrase comes back and at the end, people start believing in it, just as people believed with Brexit that things would be different, that promises would be, you can get pigs to fly, as the story was at the time, or unicorns did exist, if you remember some of the caricatures linked to Brexit. So I think, you know, this is the kind of fantasy or reassuring fantasies that are actually that circulate on social media.
Simon Cooper, you too employed the term a nationalist fantasy earlier in this conversation. No nationalist fantasy without social media?
I mean, where are people getting their election views from? I've just been around the West Midlands for the Financial Times. My sense is people are not following this at all. And I think a big change over the last few years is, yes, you used to go on Facebook and Instagram and get political comments, which was often very dubiously sourced. Now, Facebook and Instagram have downgraded their political content, so you can happily spend your days there, rarely encountering politics. So in towns I was in, like Nuneaton, I walked around for hours and hours. I saw two election posters in people's windows, two out of probably 1,000 homes. In Walsall, I didn't see a single one. So my sense is not that the UK voters are getting a lot of crazy stuff from social media. They're not getting any political news anywhere. In my sense going around was that there isn't an election in people's minds. They're going to vote on Thursday, but they are really not thinking about this very hard or very deeply, which is strange for a watershed election removing a party that's been 14 years in power.
Jamie Furlong, same scenario where you are?
Yeah, I think so. And I think my expectation really is that this is a kind of almost like a lukewarm Labour landslide, that, you know, they're going to win an enormous majority in the parliament, but not with any particular affection from the electorate. So, you know, if that change that they're promising isn't really delivered particularly quickly with kind of quite a volatile electorate, I don't think, you know, the sympathy of the electorate will last a long time.
Yeah, the Financial Times on the last day of campaigning spelling out in its opinions page a Banks cartoon that depicts a crumbling town centre with the caption, in less than 48 hours, everything is going to be great. This idea that, you know, we talk here in France a lot about when you have an election, you have two rounds, but the third round is when you decide the policies afterwards. In Britain, is Labour going to have to decide its policies afterwards, Julian Nundy?
Well, it would seem so. I think that it's not that everyone expects tomorrow to be great, but they expect to be not as bad as yesterday.
Is Keir Starmer up to this task? I mean, we don't really know all that much about him other than that he's polished.
This is true. I mean, he does not have a... He's not a very exuberant man. He's not a very outgoing man. But he's got a serious background. He was director of public prosecutions, which is an important, very important job in the United Kingdom. He's a lawyer. He's a trained lawyer, a very experienced lawyer. Which all makes a difference. I mean, lawyers tend to make good politicians.
So, Simon Cooper, does this mean that the British are going to be like the Germans were a few years back? That they're going to... They loved when they had a boring leader in Angela Merkel. And they're going from Boris Johnson to Keir Starmer. What does that say?
I think they want boring. It was a bit like going from Margaret Thatcher to John Major. After the kind of clownesque carnival of the Johnson and Truss years, particularly, there's a yearning for somebody who, a prime minister who you don't notice, a prime minister who doesn't say crazy things or do crazy things on a daily basis. And yes, Starmer is uncharismatic. He's an unexciting person. He has a dull voice. And I really think that right now, the country is ready for that. Of course, he may wear thin on people's televisions, but then nobody watches television news anyway anymore. So I think he'll be a prime minister who will largely fade into the background. My worry is that things won't get better, they will get worse, because Britain hasn't invested in public services for 14 years. So your trains wear out, your school buildings wear out, your hospitals, and Labour don't really have money and haven't promised any spending. And so the consequence is that day by day, your public services continue to deteriorate. And in a few months' time, that will be seen as Labour's problem.
What about raising taxes then?
They've ruled out raising most personal taxes. So a British tax burden as a percentage of GDP is already the highest in 70 years. So there isn't a huge amount of scope. They promised to raise taxes on rich people. That's not going to net a huge amount of money. So there really isn't going to be a big rise in public spending, a big difference from when Tony Blair took over 27 years ago, when the Treasury coffers were full and Labour was able to spend.
France Fauché, this idea that the British want boring, do the French want boring? Is it when you compare the two, I mean, this...
It's a very interesting question. I think with Bardella, we get, in a way, almost the equivalent, but in a slightly different way. Bardella is a pure marketing product.
This is the lead candidate for the national rally.
He shows nothing. He has no ideas. He's completely loose, smooth at the moment. But we could say that there is a similarity in the boring. What I think we need to think about is that Labour has had quite a few years to actually prepare. So even though the coffers are empty, even though they've said very little in the campaign because they don't want to scare people off, one has to hope and think that they have actually prepared to quite a few things that they can implement, as New Labour had done in the first 100 days. So they probably have much more in store than they're saying. And at least that's what we can hope for the UK, because there's a lot of expectations about changes, about improvement in public services in particular.
Jamie Furlong, with the Brexit vote, there was a radicalisation of politics, and that also included the Labour Party. There was a groundswell among young people that brought Jeremy Corbyn to the leadership position at the time. He has been sidelined. Is the hard left gone for good inside of the Labour Party? And what do those young people think?
I mean, it's very difficult to know if it's gone for good, I guess. A lot will depend on future elections and how the country's economy changes. But obviously Keir Starmer has made a very concerted and deliberate and very public effort to kind of clarify that, you know, they're the party of power, not the party of protest like it was in the past. In terms of where that left vote goes, at the moment it seems to be sort of splitting between remaining with the Labour Party, potentially going a little bit to the Greens. But again, because of the way that our electoral system works, where you have to vote in particular constituencies. It's quite difficult for the Green Party in particular to get a kind of foothold in, you know, more than a few, you know, localised places like Bristol or Brighton, where they have this kind of, where there is this sort of swell of young progressive support. So for now, obviously, it doesn't affect Labour too badly in the sort of electoral map, but in the future, that remains to be seen.
This first-past-the-post system, Julian Nundy, for a long while, it did nonetheless allow for a third party, the centrist Liberal Democrats. There's no third-party dynamic, though, right now, like there was in 2010.
Well, I think this is going to be the perhaps one of the most interesting things that will come out of this election is who votes for the smaller parties, what sort of support they get. I think the Liberal Democrats should be getting a good number of seats this time. There's even some talk of them putting...
What's the difference between them and Keir Starmer?
They've become more radical. They're more radical than the Labour Party. They have
How
been
so?
For some time. Well, they're just...
They're the only ones to talk about returning to the European Union.
Oh, they do. The Lib Dems want to.
Yeah.
But the only ones who are really talking about it, the Labour Party is not daring to go down that road. I think over the years they realised the only way to catch the young vote was to become more radical, and to make themselves more interesting.
So they may be they may play a bit role, is what you're saying.
Well, yes. I mean, it looks as though Labour should get enough of a majority to be able to rule. The Lib Dems were in with Cameron, after all. Some years ago in the coalition, which has left bad memories.
We'll see if 14 years is long enough for voters to forget. The Conservative Party, who, by the way, in its present incarnation dates back to 1834, it's one of the oldest parties in the world, now has to decide its future direction, whether it's mainstream. This is images from when Rishi Sunak announced the snap election. Or whether it's nativist hardliners like the former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, already want to steer the party to the right. Which direction now? Jamie Furlong, let me begin with you.
Some of it will actually depend on how many Conservative MPs are even elected, because, I mean, there's, you know, potentially they could be reduced to 60, 70 MPs. So, you know, the split in the...
So it is just for our viewers to understand, it is the members of parliament who rule the party, is what you're saying.
I mean, I think the members of parliament are going to have a huge direction. Of course, also it's in the, you know, it's part of the Conservative Party's constitution that in order to be elected as leader, you have to be an MP. So, you know, whoever ends up as the Conservative leader after Rishi Sunak is going to come from what remains of their MPs.
Simon Cooper, we've seen... we used to have a big tent centre-right party. It's dissolved. Some of it has gone to Macron. There's still a rump party called Les Républicains. Others have allied with the far right. Is that the fate of the Tories?
Well, everywhere in Western Europe, North America, and I think South America, the only centre-right party currently in power are the British Conservatives, and they're going to lose power tomorrow. So that means that the centre-right in the Western world has been decimated. You see the takeover of the centre-right by the far-right, Trump eating the Republican Party, the Rassemblement National eating the Républicain. In Holland, the far-right has become bigger than the centre-right and now leads the new government. So I think the Tories are going to see the international wind, the remaining Tories, and the first thing they'll try is become a far-right party like the Rassemblement National. I mean, yes, it does depend on which MPs survive, but I think the energy of the party in the next few months is going to be fighting an internal battle, ignoring the Labour government, and saying the reason we lost is we weren't radical enough. We weren't anti-immigrant, pro-Brexit, tax-cutting enough. And they are going to go down that route first. I don't think it's going to be a happy route for them, but it will take them a few years to get out of that, I suspect.
France Fauché, how do you explain this shift to the right?
I think that brings us back to the question of radicalization and whether or not the British people are becoming more moderate. I think clearly there are elements also of radicalization, and here it's happening, it's going to happen within the Conservative Party. They didn't manage to get rid of UKIP, or UKIP is coming back in the person of Farage and in the Reform Party. That will actually do real damage to the Conservative Party in the votes tomorrow, and therefore in the number of seats that they will have. So the question in the future will be, how does the Conservative Party rebuild itself? Which leader can it elect? And it's very likely that Sunak, who has announced that he was going to take full responsibility, will resign. He may actually, I mean, apparently he's nervous about losing his seat. So they will have to choose somebody else. And with the system that they have put in place since 98, the people who will vote are the radicalized members of the party and the people who will join. So that's a real interesting question. The other question, I think, is linked to what happens to the other parties. So, of course, Labour will have probably such a huge majority that the other parties in Parliament won't count for much. However, that will mean some unruliness potentially in a huge majority. MPs can dissent much more easily. But also, it encourages votes for the Greens, and the Greens may have more than one MP in the future. The Lib Dems, as we are saying, may also increase the number of MPs that they have. So it will, you know, with the Conservative Party being maybe only twice the size of the Lib Dems, that will be a really, really different parliament that we will see in 2 days.
So before we go, I have to ask Jamie Furlong, I guess what you call it, the France 24 question here, because nobody's, or except possibly excepting the Lib Dems, is talking about Brexit on the campaign trail. On this side of the channel, we're all thinking about it, and those pesky passport controls is just the start of it. What's the future relationship between Britain and the European Union? How do the voters see it?
That's a massive question. It's very difficult to answer. I've actually just seen this evening that Keir Starmer came out and said that it's unlikely that Britain would rejoin the EU in his lifetime, which is quite an interesting statement from the Labour Party, given that, you know, the majority of its voters voted to remain, and, you know, the remain or the desire to rejoin is growing over time. So it's hard to say, but I mean, definitely if you look at the polls and you look at the kind of public sentiment, I think it's around 60% currently when the public are polled seem to want to rejoin the EU, as some of those voters die and there's sort of change within the electorate and the sort of growing kind of increase in kind of liberal attitudes. I think that's likely to only increase. The problem for the Labour Party, and the Labour being the kind of voice of this kind of rejoining the EU, again, is the electoral system, which means that, you know, a lot of in a lot of seats, there's still a kind of a slight majority for Leave, I think.
So we know they're not going to be joining Julian Nundy, the European Union, on Friday morning, the British. But what will be the relationship?
Well, I think one can assume that a new Labour government will try to build up a new relationship, a more sensible one. The problem is with Brexit is a lot of people, many, many voters were quite ignorant. They didn't realise how much of everyday life they owed to the European Union, such as freedom of movement and such like. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing between Britain and the continent, which is now under threat. And this is one of the reasons why the National Health Service is in such trouble.
Simon Cooper, could next week we have a situation where Brussels has better relations with London than Paris?
It's very possible, yes. And I think that this Labour government is committed to good relations with Brussels, and it will go there and say, and as Florence has already thought about, what can we do now to make life easier? And so, for example, one thing is that you recognise each other's food and environmental standards. So everything all food from Britain will meet the environmental standards of the European Union, and that will just make trade much easier in one day. So there are quite a lot of things you can do quickly to make things better, also warmer mood music. And I think the step that comes next, probably in the next parliament, is, well, the pro-Brexit vote has really disintegrated and died by now, so let's talk about rejoining the customs union and all the single market. I think that will be a very live issue in British politics in the next decade, but not this year.
Simon Cooper, many thanks for being with us. I want to thank Jeremy Furlong for being with us from Hebden Bridge in West Yorkshire, as well Florence Fauché, Julian Nundy. Thank you. Our coverage of the UK elections on our website, France24.com. Thanks for being with us.